This meeting is being live streamed. What's up, everybody? This is Tobias Carlisle. This is Value After Hours. Jake Taylor is out sick today, so it's just going to be me and our special guest, Jonathan Troussard. Jonathan is a PhD. He's an economist, but he worked under Bob Merton, worked for the Ziff family in New York during the global financial crisis, was partner and head of product management at Research Affiliates from 2014 to 2021. And now he's launched his own firm, Troussard Capital Management. Jonathan, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's go back to the start. PhD in economics. What did you study? What's your area of focus?
Well, it was really kind of a three chapter kind of deal. Before I ever got to grad school, I went to UCLA undergrad, and I studied under a guy whose name was Earl Thompson. He passed away in 2010, unfortunately. And I was at UCLA in 2001, 2002, as the tech bubble was bursting. And so actually my first, love, was studying kind of the great bubbles in history, and what they had to teach us about what had just happened, with, you know, the tech bubble. So that was really kind of,
what are the great bubbles? Tulip bubble.
Yeah. 80s. Tulip bubble, Mississippi bubble, the South Sea bubble, you know, all of that.
Florida real estate, California real estate. Did they ever get bubble talk?
That's right. So, you know, just understanding kind of, you know, what makes a market go wacky.
What is it? Do you subscribe to that? Before the Black Swan, there was the Dragon King. Who's the Dragon King? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know the Dragon King. I feel like I need to go look that up. But yeah, I mean, look, they're, you know, in the taxonomy of bubbles, you know, a couple of ingredients are helpful, but you'll notice very often. And by the way, that goes back to, you know, the South Sea bubble and the Mississippi bubble, so on and so forth. New technology tends to help, right? There's this new thing out there, and whether it's, you know, traveling to colonies or, you know, the internet or AI or whatever it is, it's helpful to have, you know, that thing that kind of, you know, kind of gets your
new paradigm,
the new paradigm. Thing. Thank you. And yeah. Again, literally, if you think about, you know, the Mississippi bubble, the South Sea bubble, which were about, hey, there is this whole new place out there. And if we can get there, we can get the riches, you know, type of deal.
The metaverse.
Yeah, it actually very quickly sounds familiar. So that was chapter one in my studies. But long and short of it is, I have been a student of markets and again, of that, like what happens when markets go, you know, bonkers for a very long time. As an aside, again, I think there is the kind of narrow market dynamic part of it, which, as I said, kind of new technology, new paradigm, you know, plays a role. And then there is, you know, it doesn't hurt to have a, you know, a fertile ground from a societal standpoint where something has changed in kind of, you know, the way we think about different kinds of people, kind of societally, and, you know, wealth redistribution basically tends to play a role as well, whether it's intentional or unintentional. I studied with Earl Thompson at UCLA. I thought I was going to be a professor. I moved to Boston University to get my PhD. I absolutely loved, you know, game theory and making decisions under uncertainty type of thing. Kind of the intersection of strategy and like the world is this big unknown place. This gets in the weeds really quickly, but there is a kind of a very basic thing that you learn in your first year as a PhD student called the Arrow-Dobro economy. And it's like, hey, if you think about a world where like a bunch of things are uncertain, how do you price these uncertain kind of states of the world, right? And I was all about it, and I was really excited, and it's kind of mathy. And then in my second year, I walked into the business school at BU, and I met a guy by the name of Zvi Bodhi, who's changed my life in more ways than one. But the first way in which he changed my life was he said, everything you like about economics, all this stuff, we call it investing. How about you do that instead? And so I started, you know, learning about option and option theory. And that's how I ended up writing my dissertation on, you know, the application of option theory, which, by the way, again, is about pricing, you know, uncertain states of the world. And ultimately, I got my first job, as you mentioned, working for Bob Merton at a firm that he and a couple of other people had started in the aftermath of Long Term Capital, a place called Integrated Finance Limited, which is no longer. In fact, has been absorbed by a very large systematic quant mutual fund group out of Austin, Texas, if that gives you a sense. but anyway, so I worked for Bob for a little bit. I still thought I was going to be a professor. Again, my life got a lot more interesting in a good way when I ended up taking a job for the Ziff family in New York. I joined in June of 2008 in risk management. And as you can imagine, it was
French risk management, risk managers, all risk manage, all the best risk managers are French. Why is that?
So I don't know if that's true.
All risk managers are French.
Why yeah. So I you're making that it might be a more accurate description. I think it has something to do with the fact that risk management is again inherently about uncertainty, and uncertainty is inherently about probabilistic, a statistical understanding of the future. The French put a very high premium in school on things like statistics and math and engineering. I mean, if you think about, again, I you know, you and I come from different places around the world, and we've been students of, you know, different cultures. I think each culture has its kind of hero. And in a lot of ways, the French hero figure is a scientist. You know, kind of an engineering. I mean, if you think about, you know, the top school, they're not business schools, they're, you know, Polytechnique and they're engineering schools and all of that. So I think it's just a lot of quanti, you know, brain cycles are spent very early on by French people. You know,
it's quite risk management, is it? Risk management's more like you need to understand that there's some dark side, some downside that's not captured in the map.
Well, maybe that's the other part, which is, you know, there's a, whatever you call it, there's a very new wave existential.
Right.
You know, the French are very dark, right? They don't, they, you know, whatever. The for every optimistic American, there is a metaphysical Frenchman out there.
Right. That makes sense. You know?
So maybe that's what it is. But yeah, so, but I hesitate, you know, when you said some of the best risk managers are French. That may be true. I love my people. But I think there is something profoundly non-scientific about truly being the best risk manager, because for all the math and for all the science you can throw at it, it's about the thing that cannot be quantified. It's about the thing that feels a lot more like liberal arts.
Right.
You know, and so, and I think that's a different thing altogether, which is, you know, my first boss in this business outside of Bob, Alec Crawford, you know, always said a failure of risk management is a failure of imagination.
Right.
And I think it's profoundly true.
Probably definitionally, so you don't know who the best risk managers are, because they...
Yeah.
Nothing's ever happened.
No one ever rings the bell for the thing that didn't happen, didn't blow you up, right? Which is exactly right. You know, it's but again, I think there is a common thread to that. You know, whether it's risk management or just, you know, kind of handling crises, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, I'm, you know, it's like whatever. Like if you're a really great fire department and you put out all the fires, then you're never written up in the newspaper as having a huge blaze in your town, right? So it's like no one ever knows about you, type of deal.
So were you a risk manager through the global financial crisis?
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
It honestly could not have been a better experience. One is it focuses the mind in a huge way, and it forces you to particularly as kind of a young person, you know, when it's like you're still kind of getting started in your
All
career.
the abstraction becomes concrete. All of the events that could happen actually start happening.
That's exactly right. And the other part of it too is like you don't get to be too shy to put your hand up. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, hey, I saw this thing. It's worth talking about. And I think that's really hard, right? For a lot of people, kind of, I mean, in going into any industry, but particularly in our profession, where, you know, you kind of, there's, you know, the people that have authority and power tend to be, you know, a little bit further along and so on and so forth. It's not, you know, it's not Silicon Valley. It's not a bunch of 22-year-olds changing the world in hoodies. And so you got a bunch of guys in fancy suits on the other side of the table, and you feel like you're just the kid, but you're like, hey, no, this we really need to talk about. And I think that's you know, that was super educational. And look, I mean, the thing was, particularly at a place like Ziff Brothers Investments at the time, all risks were relevant. It wasn't just equity risk. It was commodity risk. It was, you know, the hedge fund next door that had to delever in a hurry. It was, you know, it was just every aspect of it was in play. I was just visiting New York last week, and I was reminded that we shared basically, you know, one of those public atrium type of places with MF Global. Remember MF Global? And it's like, whoa, what happened there? You know, so it was just all of that stuff. So that was really good. And this is where, you know, you don't know how lucky you are in real time because you're probably too young and you lack, you know, the perspective to actually really appreciate it. But working for the Ziff family through it was incredible because it gave us, you know, it was a position of strength. It was permanent capital. It was, you know, people that were fully aligned. You know, they didn't hire you to, you know, have a bunch of yes men around. It was just a great culture, a great place to be. And so, you know, I got stupidly lucky very early in my career.
And then research affiliates. Let's talk research affiliates first. Bob, Rob Arnott has an interesting take on why the fundamental indexes are not valued. Do you want to have a go at that?
Totally. And by the way, I think it's very relevant to the markets we're seeing today. And again, I was a research affiliate for 7 years. I was a partner and head of product. I ran, you know, kind of strategy around the world for a number of years. And I love my former colleagues, whether it's Rob or, you know, our my former CIO, Chris Brightman, or, you know, my former CEO, Katie Sherrard, who's actually now an advisor to my firm, which is just fabulous. But look, what do we know? Research affiliates, you know, very large, quantitative asset manager, about $150 billion around the world, as you noted, a lot of it in a strategy called the Fundamental Index, which really is kind of one of the early movers on, you know, the whole smart beta thing. And I think your description is correct, which is if you ask Rob, is the fundamental index, which is a lot like a capitalization weighted index, except you remove the cap weights and you replace them with, you know, more stable things called fundamental weights that kind of sort of look like market capitalization weights, except they don't move very much. You know, to equate that strategy with a narrow value strategy, in the, you know, index sense of the term, like, you know, Russell value or something, I don't, you know, I'm just picking one at random, is very different. There's something different, and pun was not intended, but there was something fundamentally different about picking cheap stocks and then market cap weighting them versus picking, you know, presumably more stocks and then anchoring them to something fairly stable and then rebalancing against those price movements to that stable anchor. They're both going to give you a value tilt, right? But in a weird way, if all you do is you take the cheap stocks and then you kind of reassign to them their market capitalizations, and if you have any belief, right, this is the belief part, if you have any belief that there is, like, quote unquote, a fair price out there, you just don't know what it is, but you know that market capitalization probably swings too far in both directions, right? When something gets spooky and scary, people run away. And so your market cap falls further than it should. And of course, when people get really enamored with something, you know, the market cap kind of goes too far in the other direction. You get a sense that you're basically leaving value-ness on the table, if you will, by using market cap weights, because the ones that are real value, they have a tiny weight because their market cap is too small relative to what they should be. Right. And so I think that's what Rob is trying to say when you know, people hear it the way you're describing it, which is all the fundamental weights do is they give you a stable anchor against which to rebalance. And when a stock craters and it becomes deep value, you're going to end up having to buy more of it to go back to that stable anchor. And as a result of that, you're kind of doubling up on your value exposure. So it's, you know, it's, again, I'm not a research affiliates anymore. I'm not trying to give you the line, but the distinction is between kind of what you wouldn't want to describe as static value versus dynamic value. That's the way to think about it.
Let me just give a quick shout out to all the folks who've dialed in from around the world. Hola from Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. How are you? Toronto, Dead Cat Gully. We're still in the gully. Got to get that bounce sometime soon. Kotor, Montenegro, Toronto, Chapel Hill, Valparaiso, London, Abu Dhabi, Grimsby in Ontario, Canada. How are you? Durham, Stockholm, Sweden, two times, Tallahassee, Hamburg, Germany, London, Nashville.
No French people, huh?
Estonia, no French. Guatemala, Istanbul, Turkey, Belfast, Sydney, Jupiter, Florida. Congrats, you've made it. Nice. Jonathan, and you've now launched your own firm. What do you do at your firm? What's the focus there?
Trussard Capital Management is a boutique wealth management firm. And it really is, one, the expression of, you know, everything we just talked about, which is 20 years of being in the markets, thinking about markets in a very real way, and now delivering that to, you know, clients who, you know, really have three distinct attributes. One is they want an investment professional. You know, I say to people, look, if you want a steak dinner and a golf outing, I'm sure you can do a lot better than me. And that's unequivocally true. Two, someone who's going to be on your side of the table. You know, I run a fiduciary firm. And three, someone who's going to empower you with knowledge. Whether I like it or not, again, I thought I'd be a professor. I believe in the power of sharing what you know, and hopefully my clients, you know, who tend to be high performing professionals in their own field, can take that knowledge and carry it with them in their own professional lives. The other thing that I say, because it really is part of this energy that I just carry with me, and by the way, that I inherit from research affiliates, which is about, you know, kind of testing and pushing back on the status quo for the benefit of investors, is, you know, I say, look, I help people and organizations escape the wealth management industrial complex. And I think people get that, you know, it's a good kind of chuckle line. And that's what I do. So it's been a huge amount of fun, and it feels so good to be, you know, delivering a distinctly different experience to people in wealth management.
So philosophically, what do you believe? What are you, trying to express for your clients in their portfolios?
So there is what someone like you, someone like me would describe as narrowly investment beliefs, and we can get to that in a second. But before we get to investment beliefs, which really have to do with, again, how do you think markets work, right? You know, my belief as far as wealth management is concerned is it really kind of revolves around three principles. attention, intention, and purpose. Attention is like, hey, is someone actually staring at your stuff and making sure it's clean? You know, is someone doing the basic, you know, housekeeping, house cleaning? And in a lot of cases, unfortunately, you find that it's not true. Intention, which starts to bleed a little bit closer to investment beliefs, is about, hey, asking the question, what is this money for? And when you know, once you know what this money is for, then you can actually leverage, again, some of the knowledge that you and I were just talking about, things like in, you know, in the, if you're going to use jargon, you know, financial engineering, but a huge amount of it is just structuring. Hey, if you want money in 2026, don't mess around with, you know, Markowitz mean variance. That's ridiculous. Go buy a bond that matures in 2026. You know, it's just kind of that kind of structuring aspect of it. And then, you know, I talk about purpose, which is forget what the money is for. Let's start talking about what is this money about. And I find that in a lot of cases, particularly people that have been very fortunate in this world to, you know, accrue a lot of wealth fairly quickly, you know, they don't want their money to define them. And the best way to do that is to define it. If you turn it around, you know, people get a sense of like, okay, this is where it fits in my life, as opposed to like this, you know, it's like whatever you call it, kind of the winner's curse. But when it comes to investment beliefs, you know, and again, I believe that investment beliefs, that's a lot of believing in one sentence. You know, I'm always wary of being dogmatic. And so I continue to test my own investment beliefs. I think sincerely that because, as I told you, I started in this world thinking about bubbles and all of that, markets are susceptible to behavioral biases. And in the worst of cases, you know, real behavioral excesses to the upside and the downside. When you start from that premise, then very quickly you're forced to be kind of value centric or value oriented, because the whole idea of human psychology pushing markets too far, you know, too far to the upside or too far to the downside is, well, when the stuff is really blown up and no one wants to touch it, that's going to be a pretty good price. And of course, when this, you know, when everybody's enamored with it and, you know, prices are starting to be objectively high, the data tell you that expected returns going forward are inherently lower. So, you know, being a student of bubbles and being a student of just behavioral excesses in markets very quickly gets you to a place of value and just being sensitive to prices. And I think, you know, again, I think that's all you can say is, do you actually look at the prices of the things you buy? Because if you don't, then that's going to have implications. And so that's, you know,
probably outperform. you've done much better. Let's talk about when you look at the current investment landscape, what psychopathology do you diagnose? Do you see us as being closer to bubble territory or the other end? Or where, I guess.
So what do we know? So I am on bubble watch. And I think, you know, I think it's helpful to anchor yourself to some numbers, because otherwise you're just letting your own gut kind of run. Given where CAPE ratios are, particularly in the US, you know, long-term PE ratios, it's hard to argue the stuff is cheap, right? So now it's not as crazy expensive as it was back in 1999, early 2000, and it's not even nearly as expensive as where we were a couple of years ago, which speaks to the fact that, you know, the earnings side of things on an overall basis really has caught up. So I think it's hard to say, you know, five alarm fire on bubble front, but bubble-ish, no question. And then again, I mean, you know, it's one of the things where you then have to ask yourself, what's going on here? What are the dynamics? that are causing this thing to kind of play out the way it's playing out. And as I just described to you, I tend to look at markets from a behavioralist standpoint, for lack of a better description. And yet I'm led to think that what we're seeing is a lot more of a efficient markets type of risk premium right now, as opposed to a behavioral risk premium, which, by the way, Rob Arnott would describe as a fear premium, right? What we're seeing now doesn't seem to be a fear premium. That's the whole point. That's why people like you and me are asking questions like, is this a bubble? We're not seeing a lot of fear. But I think what we're seeing is the expression of a lot of risk getting printed every day that the bad thing we're all waiting for doesn't happen. And whether it's, you know, the fact that everybody was predicting a recession last year and it didn't happen. But honestly, I think there's something even more kind of fundamental going on as you reframe capital markets, and in particular the US equity market today, from what I would describe to you as, again, this kind of efficient market risk premium lens. You know, we were talking about Earl Thompson earlier, who was, you know, really the first guy who taught me anything about economics. And we were sitting in his office at UCLA, and he said, you know why California real estate keeps going up, right? And I'm like, I don't know anything. I'm 19. What do you want from me? And he said, the reason it keeps going up is because we haven't had an earthquake today. And every day that we don't have an earthquake, the holders of the stock of California real estate have to be compensated for bearing that risk. And I think that's what's going on here. And by the way, I'm not saying that's, we don't have certainty around these things, right? But that was Earl's interpretation of why California real estate outperforms. Or, you know, has outperformed historically. I kind of hate it when people use the present tense, like it becomes like a law of physics or
like
something.
Like it's a quality of it.
Yeah. Something, you know, time. Like, no, yeah. All we know is what's happened, not... And I guess my point to you is, if you think about what's going on here with U.S. capital markets, and I'm just going to start with, you know, the AI stocks, I think there's this huge thing. Yes, you know, there's kind of the excitement, the frothiness, the bubble mentality of AI is the future and I'll pay anything for this damn thing. But I think there's something more fundamental going on here, which is AI, one, still very much feels like a non-fundamental human need. So if things go really badly from an economic standpoint, my guess is we'll choose food over computer chips. There is the other part of it, which is who's going to be buying the computer chips? Well, my suspicion is we have a pretty high appetite for them. And by we, I mean the US and, you know, the West, call it. But we know that a huge amount of the demand for them is going to be coming from China. And by the way, again, this is the stuff I don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised if some of the prices we're seeing today are reflective of some kind of premium for getting these chips into China, right? But what happens if, like, we really get divorced from China and all of a sudden Nvidia, which, you know, thought had a truly global market, really doesn't? And so the point is, I think if you're the shareholder in one of these companies that is squarely at the intersection of, you know, the new Cold War dynamics, every day that, you know, the rug isn't totally pulled out from under you is a good day, and you require compensation for that. So it's a very long way around the block to say, I don't know that we're in a bubble, but I think we're like living in a world that we haven't lived in a very long time, which is one in which there are these massive risks, cracks, whatever you want to call them, under our feet. And every day that we get to skip over these things, we just kind of cheer on and get compensated. But all it'll take is for us to kind of trip or fall through one of the cracks. And all of a sudden, you know, that massive compensation you've gotten for unrealized risk won't look all that great. So that's the way I think about it.
So to pick up on something that we were talking about before. So I said the Dragon King was the early form of the Black Swan, and the Dragon King was an idea of Didio sonnets. He had the same idea that there were these tail risks that weren't accurately. There was more probability in the tails than we thought. And so, you know, the way that Taleb expresses it is he sells near the money puts, or sells near the money options, buys the tails, and that helps you pay for it a little bit. One of the things that Didio Sonnet had, this idea of this, the Sonnet wave, which was the every initially the wave is quite big and every dip is bought. And then I think they can fit some sort of, I'm not entirely sure what the algorithm they can fit to it is, but you can see these waves when you can recognize these waves when you see them. Each dip is bought at an earlier and earlier point until it sort of reaches this singularity, I guess, in which point it sort of all falls apart. I was wondering if that sort of does describe a little bit what we're looking at, where each dip is bought increasingly aggressively and you get this sort of ski jump effect finally.
Yeah.
And so if you look at that, to me, Bitcoin looks like one of these sort of ski jump shapes right now, because Bitcoin's just hit an all-time high.
Yeah.
And then you can look at the price to sales of the tech similarly has this sort of ski jump effect to it. Have you ever come across Didio Sonnet stuff before?
I hadn't, and it's interesting, but again, I think it's very descriptive. One is, I if I'm understanding you correctly, I would agree with it. And by the way, again, it is very descriptive. It is consistent with what I'm describing to you as, you know, this buying the dip thing or whatever it is. And what I'm describing as, hey, there are these kind of cracks in the sidewalk, and we keep kind of, you know, skipping over them. And so every time you land on the other side of it, you know, again, like, go nuts, right? Go buy the dip, you know, do all these things. And so there is a happy-go-lucky quality to buying the dips and all of this type of activity. And the question becomes, when does the singularity moment happen where, hey, actually, like, that behavior that's been rewarded over and over again isn't, right? Type of thing. Again, on the Bitcoin part of it, paint me a huge Bitcoin skeptic on a variety of dimensions. One is, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know what this thing does. No one's ever been able to make a coherent argument for what it is to me.
Trading sardines.
You know, yeah, it's, but then, if you just kind of say, oh, maybe there is like this, I don't know, there's something fundamental here, which, you know, people like Trussard, you know, it's not getting, but it's there. Then it's hard just not to see this as a huge exercise, again, in what I would describe as wealth redistribution. And I don't think we've seen the half of it yet. I think people are going to really get hurt before this thing is over.
One very interesting thing about Bitcoin, as opposed to sort of other bubble assets, that they tend to have their one moment and then they disappear. You know, so not to cast shade on Cathie Wood, but ARK kind of had its run up to 2021 and it's sort of not really been able to capture the zeitgeist again, and probably not having NVIDIA or not having the AI type stocks is, you know, it is fatal, or it should be fatal for a strategy like that. And then Tesla had a pretty good run up. Tesla sort of not got back anywhere near where it was in 2021. Bitcoin seems to be able to have these. It's had, I don't know how many runs at a new all-time high.
It's like a cat has nine lives or whatever. No, I agree. I mean, so I think it doesn't, again, I think, you know, I'm always reminded, I can't wait for the hate mail. I'm always reminded of, you know, when you get these, and I think this is an honest description of it. So I don't think this is an insensitive description, but, you know, the Nigerian scam emails, right? And when someone like you or I receive the Nigerian scam email, it is so far-fetched, right, that our natural instinct is, well, this is madness, let's just delete it, right? But you know that's a feature, that's not a bug, right? Because what they want is to kind of zero in on the most gullible as quickly as humanly possible, right? If you respond to the first thing that's like misspelled and has a crazy story behind it, and if you only send me 10 grand, then my billionaire son will be able to reward you in America. Like, you've got the audience that you wanted all along. And so I think the fact that the Bitcoin story is so far-fetched is actually helping in kind of creating this forever stream of gullibility, for lack of a better description. That's step one. I think step two is again, I think it is hard to think of Bitcoin as having anything but an insider class and an outsider class. And every step of the way seems to be an exercise in giving an opportunity to the insider class to sell and the outsider class to buy. I don't know about you, but launching 40 ACK funds in spot Bitcoin seems to fit that story. And so I just think there's a lot of that
Do you think
scam.
that's what's created the rally? The fact that the ETFs have launched, there's some demand through the ETFs.
I mean, look, there are two ways price there are two ways prices move in the market, right? One is expectation, and the other one is supply and demand. This has components of both, right? There is now that there is this thing, you can expect that there's going to be even more demand in the future, or some version of that is would be the story, right? And then of course that creates demand now, which is the much more mechanical way in which prices move in markets. So it would be hard for me to believe that Bitcoin would be back to wherever, or it would be where it is today, 69,000 or whatever the price is. It's to me, that seems ridiculous to talk about a price for like a price for what. But if it weren't for that quote unquote innovation.
What about the idea that it's like short fiat? So the more money printing that goes on in the central banks around the world, there's sort of some finite number of Bitcoin out there. So you're always getting denominated in more and more fiat.
This is where like you have to nihilism has to have a limit. It's like, hey, I
I
don't
don't
believe
know if that's true, but I like the
It's
line.
like, hey, I don't believe in this thing, so I'm gonna like go with this thing that has no basis for belief. That's the way it's like, okay, you can't convince me of that. It's like,
There's only 21 million bitcoins or something like that. I forget the
that's
number.
awesome.
Somebody
If
will correct
only you
me.
could do something with them.
So, if a client comes to you and says, "In this market, what do you do? Do you look internationally? Do you look at different asset classes? How do
Yes,
you
and
approach the problem?"
so again, I want to be clear. What I, given the line of work that I'm in, every client has different circumstances, every client has different preferences. A huge amount of it is to meet people where they are and where their needs are and so on and so forth. So this is not an exercise in having unconditional beliefs and everybody gets an equal serving of them. That's number one. That being said, you look at where prices are. And by the way, most people have a lot of US equity in their diet, right? So they probably don't need more of it from me if I can help it at the margin. It's pretty clear that international equities are relatively more attractive. That's true in Europe to some degree. It certainly is true of Japan, particularly when you start thinking about not just the corporates, but you're also thinking about the currency aspect. Then you start thinking about asset classes outside of equities. Clearly, we haven't seen interest rates at these levels in a long time. So you have to ask yourself, where is the value? Well, in some, in many circumstances and many applications, that's kind of the thing I was telling you about before, the what is this money for, right? Which is kind of the fundamental question. But hey, treasuries are a pretty attractive tool right now, but it's not just treasuries. It might be high coupon government insured mortgages. You haven't seen those prices in a long time. And by the way, again, this is where the French mathy PhD guy comes back to the surface. You know what a mortgage is, right? I mean, it's basically a, but I'm talking mortgages as in Fannie and that sort of thing. It's basically a U.S. Treasury on which you've sold a call option, because if rates come down, of course people will refinance. And so then you have to ask yourself, well, when you sell an option, which is effectively what a mortgage is this option well priced or is it badly priced? Well, we know that when volatility is high, the price of the option is higher, and so it's probably, all things considered, a better time to sell that option. We know that interest rate volatility is, like through the roof right now. So you think through that quickly and you think to yourself, maybe there's value there. It's harder to argue that there is value in things like high yield. It's harder to argue simply because, the spreads are tight. And again, we haven't seen a lot of the catastrophe kind of stuff realized that would focus the attention. So that's just kind of the knowledge and analysis that I bring to each conversation. But then it really is a function of, where people are. If someone says, I get it, and I'm happy to really veer off the main, the main lane, then you explore these things more or less, completely. And then if someone, is very US centric, then you do the things you can to put a little bit of guardrails around it.
So just let me take you back there a little bit. The way you think about a mortgage is you're long a treasury and you've sold a call against it. That's because because it's callable at the mortgage
Correct. So if
the
rates, right, if rates come down, right, the value of your bond goes up, and there's a level at which that bond is worth calling, is the way, to think about prepayment risk.
Right. So there's high interest rate volatility at the moment, so that means you want to. So this is a good time to buy a mortgage in that case, to be a holder,
I'll let you make the
to be the lender.
determination, but that's the way to think about it.
That's interesting. So when you look across the where you might invest right now, what is interesting besides sort of mortgages? US equities are expensive. International equities might be more interesting. Japanese equities are interesting because they've put that floor. All of the Japanese companies, for people who don't know, have to get their book value up to, they have to get their price up to book value.
Right.
That's, I don't know what the penalty is if you don't do that, delisting su supposedly, but they're trying to get their price to book value to book value. And there's a variety of ways that they're doing that, buying back stock and taking themselves under and doing various things, but it has lit a fire under Japanese equities a little bit at the moment. They've crossed over their 30-year-old high watermark, something
Sure.
like that.
Yeah.
This is a difficult environment, as you sort of alluded to earlier, because we've got rates are high. Everybody, I think, is holding US equities in the with the idea that rates are going to drop at some time this year, and that'll push equities even higher. But it seems that equities have really sort of ignored rates for the last year or so.
Yeah. No, I again, I mean, it's, and look, these are unknowable things, right? So you can only have opinions. But it does, again, it remind, to your point, like the fact that US equities have kind of become, whatever, I don't want to say divorced, that seems aggressive, but they're not moving in a way that would be consistent with ones prior in any way that you can come up with. forces you to either kind of ex post facto rationalize things. I mean, one of the things that I heard recently, which didn't sound crazy, I just don't know that not crazy is not the same as true, is, well, it makes sense that the tech stocks, have been rallying with rates because the tech companies are sitting on a bunch of cash and therefore they're going to be earning more on the cash on the balance sheet. And I'm like, okay, but what happened to the thing you were saying last week about the fact that these are a long duration asset? And, so it's like, there's all of that stuff. So now we're like squarely in the realm of kind of attaching stories to things that have already happened, which is not helpful. But I do think, again, there's this distinct possibility. I mean, you mentioned Nassim Taleb, so I guess, I'll go there for a second. I think Nassim, by the way, I encourage you to Google Troussard Taleb when you have a second. And
have you had an exchange for this?
Well, you know how those things go. And by the way, I think he's right on more things than he's wrong. But one of the things that I think Nassim mentions in the book is, the turkey thing, right? Which is every day the turkey gets a little fatter. And if you're the turkey, you don't know that at the end of the fattening season, there's a thing called Thanksgiving. And that's what I'm worried about when it comes to some of the more expensive asset classes that have been on a, steady diet of gains recently.
I mean, that certainly seems reflected in I just saw the chart today. It was Lizanne Saunders tweeted it out that showed P ratios for tech stocks, or price to sales ratios for tech stocks. I think they've surpassed their all-time high in 2000.
Look, again, this is massive back of the envelope stuff, right? And you're infinitely more of a fundamental analyst than I. So give me a pass on, the fact that this is fuzzy on a good day. But if you think about what happened with NVIDIA last, or whatever, 2 weeks ago, right? They beat estimates by $2 billion, right? In a quarter. Is that correct?
I don't know exactly, but yeah.
Some version of that, right? Which, even if you give them credit for a full year, that's $8 billion of beat, right? The market cap went up $250 billion, right? So 250 divided by 8 is some version of 30 years, right? So they just got credit for 30 years worth of beating, quote unquote, in the course of a couple of trading sessions. I think that's kind of, it rhymes with what you're saying, Lizanne just put out and all of that. There seems to be this leverage effect on fundamental V price.
It seems to me that it's stretched, but I tend to think these things are stretched earlier than most people do. So right. they seem to run on a lot further than anybody can possibly.
And again, I think the way you resolve that, and by the way, again, this might just be, it makes you feel better about it. It makes you feel better about being wrong longer type of thing. But I think part of it is that efficient markets risk premium thing, which is it'll run until there's a real bad event. And that's when, people stop and say, wait a minute, what is this thing actually worth? And then the answer isn't super awesome. And then, people move fast. So I think that's the way you kind of explain. And I don't know if that's irrational. I mean, remember that famous line from the global financial crisis, you don't stop dancing until the music stops.
Right. Like,
what choice do people have? Are they going to elect to stop dancing? Because you can be sitting on your butt for a long time.
We've got a comment here that Bitcoin's down 7% on the session. The top or another buying opportunity for turkeys. It certainly does seem to have that, Sawnet wave sort of increasingly aggressively bought. Every dip is increasingly aggressively bought until it sort of reaches that singularity, at which point it falls apart. I learned that from John Hussman. He's written about them before, not for a little while though. It's kind of interesting. So As a PhD in economics, do you look at the macro? What are your macro thoughts?
I do. I do, though. Again, I'm not a macro economist by training. I'm much more of a financial economist, which of course means a risk economist. But I look at the macro picture. One is because I do think that it will dictate a lot of what happens on a go forward basis. Two is because that ultimately is where we all live. Financial markets are like the metaverse to the real economy, which is the IRL thing. When you look at where we are today, and because I am a financial economist, I can't help but think probabilistically about these things. You're looking at the data, and you went into this year with three distinct scenarios. One is, soft landing, which, we all know what that means at this point, which seemed like the predominant scenario going into this year. The
The most
second,
popular scenario, or the most likely, when you say predominant.
well, I think both. I think it, when December 31st closed, right? I think it was both the most popular, but it was one of those things where it didn't sound crazy, and you had to have a truly differentiated view to say, well, I think the people that are arguing for soft landing are crazy. You know what I mean? So I think it felt like the most probable, which of course there's a long way from most probable to guaranteed, right? AKA an infinite road. Because you can never guarantee anything. And I thought going into this year that the other two scenarios would be second in line would be some version of a harder landing because the economy had been already kind of punched in the face a lot with rate hikes and so on and so forth. And then third in line was, ultimately what I think we're seeing now, which is this reacceleration. And the reacceleration, while it felt improbable going into this year, seems like it's happening. And again, unfortunately, I don't think you can reaccelerate, to infinity. And that's going to be the one that bites. And I know I'm I don't like to be in conversations where it goes something like this. No, you're right. No, you're right. I think it's good to disagree, but I think you and I probably both read what Jeremy Grantham writes and pay attention to what he says. And I think he said it well, which is until the AI craze started, we were well on our way to kind of slowly, gently deflating. And then this thing just kind of lit a fire under. So maybe that's your wave thing. Maybe that's your buy the dip thing, and the singularity has only been pushed out a little bit. But anyway, when I look at the macro, I think right now we are seeing this reacceleration on a couple of fronts.
What do you think? So there's this idea that the bubbles that form are sort of not necessarily are the symptoms of the core of the illness, and the illness itself is sort of untreated. I think that the potentially the cause of the reacceleration is the deficit spending, just massive deficits being run under the guise of the Inflation Reduction Act and so on. If you push that, we're at like eight, or we're at like record deficits outside of a
What was it, an additional trillion in 100 days or something? I mean,
One
the
or two
number.
trillions real money at some point in
Yeah.
an economy of this size.
Yeah. What do you, what, what's the,
A
a
billion
million
here, a
here, a
billion
million
there.
there quickly. It's real money,
Yeah.
So yeah.
Do you
So
have a view? Is that feasible? Is that possible, that idea that it's fiscal, even though there's monetary tightening going on, or there's the rates are high, the Fed's draining its balance sheet a little bit. But there's so
yeah.
much spending coming on out of the federal government that sort of
No, I
washes
mean,
away any of that.
yes. I mean, again, I think we're having a hard time. I mean, unfortunately, You know, again, I don't like to knock on the Fed. I think whether they're competent or not, I don't think they're out to screw up. You know what I mean? I think they're well intended, and they might be wrong nonetheless. I think one of the issues we're having is we're not going about governing ourselves very well when it comes to, you know, our elected officials. And I think what you're seeing is a symptom of that, which, you know, again, we're spending in a, it's like revenge spending. It's like, it's not like we have a plan. It's like, we're just like, you know, whatever. And it's like, if it's my turn to say what we're going to spend on, then we're going to do it my way. You know, there's just no compact.
It's not partisan either, just in case anybody, I always get this.
Yeah, no, that's
you only
exactly
complain
right.
About it when one party's, but it's both sides, and there's no solution.
And I hope you heard my comment in the same tenor. I think it's just, we just don't know how to govern ourselves anymore. And by the way, again, this goes back to, I hate to harp on it, but it's one of my interpretations of, like, you know, what's going on with the U.S. The U.S. is just like, against all odds, like still standing type of thing. You know what I mean? And it has some of that, like, well, gee, I wonder what kind of falls apart quality to it, you know? And so yeah, I think part of it is deficits, you know, which is kind of a gentle, slow death, you know, type of thing. But there's just a lot of that going on. So, look, yeah. You see it now in PCE inflation and all of that. I mean, it's pretty clear that until like a really bad thing happens, like inflation isn't coming down much more. Housing is where it is, and by the way, no one seems to be in any mood to pay less for a home or accept a lower price on their home when they sell. You know, basic commodities, you know, crude oil, whatever, like they're done kind of normalizing. There's a lot of geopolitical risk around the world, which explains some of that. And then the other stuff, you know, it's like, okay, great. Like the price of eggs has stopped, you know, going up like 157% a minute. You know what I mean? But it's like, is that like, have we solved the problem? And by the way, that's not a real statistic. But you get the point.
Many,
you know,
commodities had the pig went through the snake. They all had that bump where they had, I think Taleb calls it, there were shortages followed by gluts.
Right. Well, the thing with commodities, right, it's, I mean, and again, this is where commodities are tricky and commodities are interesting all at once. The promise of commodities, right? I mean, you were just talking about what I guess someone would call the promise of Bitcoin, which is fixed supply versus infinite supply of US dollars, is the best version of that argument. The promise of commodities has always been, hey, the supply is kind of sort of fixed in the short term, but you know, the demand is real, and so that becomes your inflation hedge and all of those types of things. But of course, the last 40 years have been a story of technological surprises to the upside, where we've always found a way to get more of everything. And I don't care if it's more oil or more natural gas or just more things out of our agricultural sector. It's just, you know, technology has been this incredibly disinflationary force, right?
There's this idea that being long commodities is being short human ingenuity, and that's been
right,
a bad trade,
right,
because we find more and we use it more efficiently when we find it.
Fabulous, fabulous summary, right? And I would caution us against betting against humanity, because that bet has been met and lost many times. And I also think we can't afford for that to happen. So it's a little bit, you know, it's like, again, I, you know, in a world, I don't, by the same token, I don't think we can afford for America to not be America on the world stage. You know what I mean? It's just all these things, like all these things where it's like, hey, if the thing you're worried about happens, really does happen, like you got bigger problems. Yeah. So yes. So I think commodities are tricky. But we seem to be increasingly capable of shooting ourselves in the foot.
On that note, Jonathan, we're coming up on full time. If folks want to follow along with what you're doing or get in touch, how do they go about doing that?
Sure. So please go to my website, trussard.com. T as in Thomas, R-E-U, double S as in Sam, A-R-D as in David.com. And again, if you are curious about what it looks like to work with me in a wealth management capacity, then, you know, please reach out. There's a contact us button on the website. Otherwise, my email address is jonathan@trussard.com. That's Jonathan at trussard.com. And maybe you can share that through your notes as well. But importantly, again, I think about this stuff all day long. I love to share my thoughts. And I have a newsletter that I send out probably once or twice a month. I try to be a light spammer, so it won't be overwhelming. But if you go to my website and you go down to the bottom of any page, there's a form to fill out, a box to fill out. You put your email address in, and you'll automatically get my newsletter once or twice a month in your inbox. So I'd love for you to do that. Anybody's welcome to do that. Again, it's just a way to keep hearing, you know, the way I think about things. And again, much like it was a real pleasure to share my thoughts with you and your audience today. If all we do in this world is help educate and help people think a little more constructively and aggressively about, you know, mystifying things like markets and the economy, then I think we're all better off. So, you know, that was great.
Thanks for your time, Jonathan. Folks, we'll be back next week. It's hopefully Jake's back on deck. He's feeling a little bit better then. And we'll have Chris Bloomstrand to talk about his annual opus.